Good afternoon, everybody. We should get started. I'm Paul Yock. I want to welcome you to this Innovators Workbench. I want to mention a couple of things. First of all, we are doing an audio recording, so if you could please turn your cell phones to vibrate or off, that would be terrific. I want to thank the sponsors for this evening's event, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Wilson Sonsini, Goodrich, and Rosati. And we have David here, courtesy of Wendover. So we appreciate that very much. David's going to introduce our guests. I just wanted to mention that there'll be a reception afterwards, so you're welcome to schmooze a bit at the end. And then for your questions, I think I'll move the mic over to the middle, if that's all right. And we'll ask you to, at the end, come up to the microphone and ask your questions into this. So, David, let's roll.
Paul, thank you very much. Well, thank you all for coming. You know, I think that there is something inherently distinctive about everybody we have at Innovators Workbench. They wouldn't be here if there wasn't something distinctive and distinguished. But I think tonight you're going to hear a really unusual and very, very novel approach to the whole enterprise of medical device creation and medical technology development. It's really been my pleasure over the course of the last year or so to get to know Howard Levin on my far right, your far left, and Mark Gelfand in between us better. They are here representing Corida, which is their, well, we'll define what it is in just a second. You may know them best for their work at a company, background work at a company called Ardian, one of the true phenomenal success stories in this industry. But they've got it really a much deeper and richer history than simply Ardian, as successful as that was. So let me begin right away. And just, as I said, I think most people here, to the extent that they know you guys at all, think of you as the guys behind Ardian. But you're actually here as part of Corida, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. What is
Corida? Corida, but it's, you can pronounce it. Does it come with money?
No. We made it hard to pronounce on purpose.
Yeah.
So tell us what the kind of goal or aim of.
Well, Corida is our mothership, as Howard calls it. You know, that's where all the ideas come from, and it spins out companies. So you could say it's very much like an incubator, but it's not a very standard model of an incubator. It has its own strange twist. And that twist probably, as we found over time, is mostly in our slow pace. We maybe cook one company in 3 years, as many incubators run simultaneous projects. And we generally focus on our own ideas and our own intellectual property, which we generate within Corida. And we tend to go into a wide space, some area where there is really almost no device therapies at the moment when we start. So these are the character.
So Howard, you described it for me as an idea generator. What do you mean by that? And how do you make the leap from idea generation to company creation? Is that not something that you guys spend a lot of time on?
Well, you know, it's interesting. What we're sort of, Mark hates when I use this word, but we're truly dinosaurs. So what we do is, you know, we're systems physiologists by training. So what we'll do is we'll try and find an unmet clinical need and try and find an idea that usually known but unexploited physiology that we can then turn into a therapy. So do we really develop devices? Per se, we don't develop devices. What we do is we develop a therapy that happens to use a device. And you know, that initial device could be kludged together from off-the-shelf stuff, or it could be something that we specifically made for that therapy. But in really what we do is we try and integrate, you know, sort of disparate or unknown things were poorly known things into some great, brilliant physiological approach and hide the stuff that doesn't work.
So I think probably the best way to illustrate would be to use an example. And let's save Ardian for right now. And let's go to one of the earliest projects that you guys worked on together, which is CHF Solutions. Give us a little bit of sense of what CHF Solutions was, what it was designed to do, and how did your focus on physiology lead to what became CHF Solutions?
Yeah, it's actually an interesting example because I'm a heart failure transplant cardiologist by training. Mark and I met at Hopkins together. We shared a desk, and Dr. Pop will tell you we were damn lucky to get that desk. You know, it was smaller than here, and you know, I went from Hopkins. I went out to Columbia, ran a LVAD program at Columbia for a while, and then went out to my first startup, which was a, strangely enough, an LVAD startup. Mark and I met back again in 99 when we started CHS Solutions, which was Intellicardia.
That was its original name.
That was the original name. And the what we were doing
very
at the time...
Very pretentious, as a matter.
Yes. What we were doing at the time was to, you know, as a heart failure cardiologist, and Mark spent a lot of his life now in cardiology, working in cardiology at Hopkins with us. What we ended up doing was trying to fake the kidney into thinking it was normally perfused to treat heart failure. So, in heart failure, compensatory mechanisms get turned on, the kidney retains sodium, it pumps out different hormones, vasoconstriction occurs, vicious cycle of heart failure, et cetera, really bad. What we wanted to do is make it believe that it was getting normal blood flow, normal blood pressure, therefore it would not do all the bad things and everybody would be happy. So we started, started interestingly, and it, a few years later ended up as part of Ardian, the concept ended up as part of Ardian. We cut the renal artery, stuck a catheter into the renal artery, and started perfusing it with a bypass pump that we happened to have. Open the Belly did this. And we're making tons of urine, tons of urine, tons of urine. Eventually, we made a catheter, put it into the renal artery endovascularly, and we got a lot more urine, but it just wasn't as much. And we couldn't figure out why that, but we figured out, we said, well, gosh, something's happening, and we'll get to a little later when it gets to Ardian about how that led us to part of the renal nerve stuff. But with CHF Solutions, it taught us a number of great lessons. One is we didn't know what we were doing. So the first thing that we did was to...
Did you have the intention of starting a device company or simply proving that if you... if you can fool the kidney.
At that time, we actually wanted to start a device company.
We had seed money from a venture capital fund, which by itself answers that question. We by had the
way,
to deliver
by
a
By the
company.
Way, this was Mark's first approach to venture capital, which was really, really good. Okay, so Kurt Wheeler, at the time he was with MBM, gives us $1 million. We come out to San Francisco for our first board meeting. We got Luke Yevon in there. We got Kurt Wheeler there. And they say, so what do you plan to do with your $1 million? And Mark says, we're putting it on red. He goes, what do you mean you're putting it on red? He goes,
we did prepare the projection, you know, for return on investment. And
it looked better to put it on red.
It looked very good on paper.
It was really, if you look at the IRR on it, it's really good if you hit. So.
Yeah. Annualized, it looked good. Otherwise, it didn't. But yeah, so in any case, so yes, we had to produce a company, but we had some time to put our thirds together in a very early one because the burn rate is very low. And in the process, we, as Howard said, the third that occurred to us is, and this is a paradox, the billions of dollars spent in heart failure management on those patients simply because they become fluid overloaded, they're admitted to the hospital, they're not making enough urine, they're not excreting sodium. They keep retaining that sodium for whatever reason. You throw drugs at them, there is no tomorrow. There's so many doctors working on them, they still retain sodium. There is nothing wrong with their kidney. These are not renal failure patients. Their kidneys are capable of excreting as much sodium as you want and as much water as they want, but they don't. And that was the question that was stuck in our mind. Why wouldn't those kidneys do it? Obviously, something was preventing them from doing their function. The renal function itself is not a problem. And I don't think anybody was thinking about this problem in those terms at the time.
So what device, I mean, what it's a great insight, but what technology?
So our initial device was supposed to be a KVAD, a kidney VAD. You know, we came out of the LVAD world, so we said, okay, we have a big VAD, we're going to make a little VAD, and we're going to perfuse the kidney. But at that time, this 99, everybody said, you got to have an acute device to get cash flow so that you can make, you know, have cash flow to fund your company while you do it, which is one of the biggest lies I've seen. But in any case, that was the story at the time. So we made this catheter, and we found out, you know, it just wasn't practical. But and Mark kept coming up to me in every day and saying, you know, this ultrafiltration thing works. It's been working for 30 years. Why aren't we building a simple ultrafiltration device? I said, no, we're perfusing the kidney. We're perfusing the kidney.
Well, we're running out of money at this point.
Right. So we almost ran out of money, and we raised $5 million. And at the board meeting a week later, we said, by the way, we're not doing that project anymore. We're doing the ultrafiltration.
Why didn't they fire us right away is still a mystery. One day we'll find out what the truth is. But they should have.
Well, we figure we had one board cycle to come up with something really good before they fired us after that. So what we did was to, you know, ultrafiltration and all these dialysis stuff work really well, but cardiologists hate nephrologists because it's a pain in the ass. You got to call them. They come. They act, you know, really important, and they bring the dialysis nurse. They bring these really complex dialysis machines. And how many nephrologists are here? I'm really screwed now. It's really hard. So you can't do it. You want to do it as a cardiologist. You want to take off fluid right then. We wanted to do it in the outpatient setting, but of course we started in the patient setting. So we made something really simple. We made wasn't purple. It was.
Periwinkle.
Device that was periwinkle that had a red button and a green button and did everything for you. It was perfect. You know, we said, so I remember, this is great. We had our business projections and we're saying, this is really great. We're going to make a lot of money. And all these things are based on being used 3 times a week, you know, whatever. So we got our 510K and we're at this International Society for Heart Transplant. And there were more people in the paint than, you know, couldn't fit any more people in the booth. We're going, wow, this is really fantastic. This is going to be great. We sponsor this meeting afterwards. People come. And I still remember to this day, the woman who was the head of the heart failure at the VA in San Diego comes up and says, I'm going to use this all the time. I'm going, wow, that's really great. You're going to use this all the time? How many times? She said, at least twice a month. I'm saying, good.
And we just did all these market projections, you know, that utilization was something like 3 patients a day or whatever.
Right,
it was.
Exactly.
So
and I'm having
way outside
2 patients a month. And it's like, you know, and so
our revenue
this was
collapsed.
Our real introduction to one, it didn't use any of the skill sets that heart failure cardiologists have, right? Heart failure cardiologists do what? They give pills. That's what I did for a living, except doing heart biopsies. Then I gave pills. So then the other thing is heart failure cardiologists don't like extracorporeal blood circulation. Nephrologists like extracorporeal blood circulation. Number 3, heart failure cardiologists don't have a budget for diddly.
We could have started with that already. So
we should have started with that, but they don't have a budget for diddly. So that means not only could they not buy the disposables, they couldn't even get the capital equipment piece into the hospital.
And yet, interestingly enough, as you describe it as all the missteps, CHF Solutions actually had a nice run and eventually found an exit.
For a nephrology company.
Yeah,
they waited
us out, which was an interesting thing, right? So we had an offer to buy it at a 5X when we had, you know, our Series A in. Mm-hmm. And I think it was bought for not a heck of a lot more, maybe, you know, 7X or whatever that first thing is, but because Gambro could wait it out. There was one acquirer. So if you want to learn something, don't build something that has
one acquirer. They know exactly how much they're going to pay for your company.
But clinically it worked very well. Yeah. I think that's the theme across our things. Not every one of the things that we built has become a large commercial success, but they've usually worked out well. You know, clinical success has made it into the, you know, some money. Yeah.
So we did an interview with these guys in Invivo, and I think it was Mark, you said to me that one of the keys that you discovered at CHF Solutions was to find things that work in the clinic. How did you make that leap? How do you make that leap today from things that have a sound physiological rationale or base to them to things that work in the clinic? Because as you experienced, and certainly is true in cardiology, adoption issues in medical devices are more about, does the physician comfortable using this device? Is it similar to stuff that he's currently using so he doesn't have to be retrained and find a new orientation? How do you cross that leap if one of the strengths of your approach is basic science?
Well, our obviously the right answer is with great difficulty and too much embarrassment. We would have done it much faster if we knew what we were doing. So it was by trial and error that we crossed it. And in the end, it's also important to remember where in the device adoption cycle you are, because we just had an interesting conversation with interventional cardiologist about interventional hypertension, which is the renal denervation area. And we asked him those questions, how far can you push the interventional cardiologist in terms of, will they do this? Will they approach from the different side? Will they make a hole in the head to get to that? And what he said in the end was striking to me, it was really interesting. He said that now when they realize that interventional hypertension is an important franchise for them, they are not going to let it go. They will fight for it and they will learn new skills in order to keep it. But when they just started, you have to do something that they understand very well. So you cannot compare this early introduction that happened the first. You need to find a door which is really open for you. You know, you cannot force the technology.
But, you know, answering your question a little bit differently, I mean, we shout out to Steve Shapiro, okay? So Steve Shapiro was with the Wilkerson Group, ATV, Galen. And early on, we learned from him basically what we heard here today. You know, we have our matrix for going through things. You know, same thing that everybody talks about, technical risk, clinical. You know, first start with the unmet need. If you don't have an unmet need, forget it. Big enough market, et cetera. You know, then we go through the whole thing. So what is Caridia different from other incubators? So what we do is, and one of our VCs, where's John? John's here. John Weiler's here. So SV and Third Rock are currently funding us. So we have a very good relationship with them. And what we've done is to develop a system where we start with a bunch of ideas. And eventually, over the course of, you know, 6 to 12 months, it ends up being up to maybe 25 ideas. All those are basically, for the most part, initially evaluated on paper. You never get to the lab, you never get to do anything until you evaluate it. And we don't start with a widget. We start, what's the technical risk, what's the clinical risk, regulatory risk, IP risk, you know, everything to who's the potential acquirer, what are comparables, who carries the bag, is it a logical, you know, is what you're thinking about, what would be the logical, you know, referral pathway. The whole thing that we heard here at BioDesign, it was like really impressive today. It was a lot of fun to listen to all this. So these guys are getting trained like amazingly well. It took us like 15 years to figure this out, that they're learning in a year. But, you know, then we get down through, after that, you know, 6 to 12 months, we get down to maybe 3 to 5 ideas that you can move ahead into the lab, test them out, and then come out on the other end with that one idea that would go to Series A, et cetera. And I got to say, it's been a really, really great experience. And a lot of it, you know, has to do with, or has nothing to do with what's the device. So what do we do differently than other people? We end up actually trying to come up with a therapy that we can test, get clinical data, put an enormous amount of, as much as we can, IP around it, and then it happens to need a device to do.
Well, one of the other things that you do that's different, I think, is to focus on basic research. I mean, when we did the interview for Vivo,
right,
we talked a lot about doing the kind of basic research that pharmaceutical companies do, but device companies rarely do. When you say you generate 25 ideas that which you then whittle down to 3 or 5, is there a bias to your approach? I mean, are these all cardiovascular or nephrological approaches, or are you open to anything? How do you elaborate on that notion of beginning with a kind of basic science that pharma companies do? Because pharma companies, you know, as something like Viagra shows, can be very serendipitous in where their research leads them to.
Well, you know, Ardian was serendipitous. I mean, there was a reason to it, but there was a couple serendipitous things that went with it. But, you know, we like to stay within the areas that we're comfortable in. So cardiology, pulmonary, renal, you know, maybe GI. We tend not to do things like, you know, ophthalmology. You know, Hansen's done a bunch of ophthalmology stuff.
Or orthopedics. We probably will not. We tried once, and it's pretty ridiculous, actually. Yes. So we said, it. Now let's go back.
But we hit it well.
But also, you know, we obviously have a PET area, which is what we call autonomic balance. So, you know, sympathetic, parasympathetic balance. We think it's the root cause of multiple disease states. And if you look at the diseases, such as hypertension, heart failure, diabetes, sleep apnea. You know, these are big problems. Mm-hmm. And then there should be enough work for us and 50 other companies left in that area. So we probably don't have to go very far outside.
So this is probably a good segue to the Ardian story, because all the things you ticked off are things that Ardian's technology, renal denervation, can ultimately or might ultimately be able to treat. And I know there's a connection you were hinting at, Howard, before, right, of the work you had done at CHS Solutions and what eventually became Ardian. But as anybody knows the Ardian story knows, it kicked around for a real long time. Even the foundry guys dismissed it a couple of times as a science project. It took a long time to catch on. Take us through the very early stages of what you were seeing and how Ardian came out of that.
Okay, so Mark and I are sitting there, and people came up to us after CHF Solutions and said, you know, this taking off this fluid, this is a really great idea. People feel a lot better. This is fantastic. Let's make an implantable ultrafiltration device. And we had absolutely no idea how to make an implantable ultrafiltration device and decided we weren't going to do it. But it still showed us that taking off fluid was an important thing. So one of the things we noticed during that IntelliCardia things back in, you know, 99, 2000, was that all of a sudden, you know, you had urine in one situation, didn't have urine in another situation. And, you know, in addition, we started thinking about, let's control the kidney. There's got to be some controls, because when we did, one of the things we did for animal model to test whether we could generate urine with the direct renal perfusion, or direct renal therapy we called it, was to do this hemorrhagic model of heart failure, of shock. So what happens is we would try and put them into shock and perfuse one kidney and measure urine output of both. So, but we noticed at some point, no matter what you did, the kidney shut down. Even you could be perfusing at 200 millimeters of mercury, you could be giving it flow up the wazoo, zero urine, nothing. Couldn't help it. And we still didn't understand this for the life of us. We were sitting there, and, you know, so now in parallel, we're thinking, okay, there's got to be some control over the kidney. There's stuff in the literature saying that renin and sodium retention and all these other things by the kidney are controlled by nerves going to the kidney. So we said, okay, let's look at this nerve stuff. So we started looking at it, and there was all sorts of things that were sort of, you know, hinting. There was de Bono's work, of course, which was, you know, seminal, which, you know, looked at the effect of the different types of nerves on different actions in the kidney. Then there was these other things that started to come in. There was this work by a guy named Campisi, who's out here in California, where they would make a little bit of damage. So they take 50 microliters of phenol in a rat kidney, put it into the kidney, make a little lesion, and, you know, 6 hours later, hypertensive. But if you cut the renal nerve, the hypertension went away. There were even things in as disparate as in pediatric patients who had malformations of their kidneys. So there were these kids that had hypertension, malformation of kidneys. But when they measured the renal vein renins, because you would expect there would be high renin output driving the hypertension, there was no renin. And when they took out that lesion, there was the hypertension went away. So we said, there's got to be something here. So we started for heart failure originally, taking dogs, lowering their blood pressure, injecting lidocaine, you know, like Novocaine for your tooth, injecting it, numbing the nerves around the one kidney, and seeing which kidney, you know, if you made more urine with this kidney than the other. Then mm-hmm. we're...
No, but also, Kurt, you need to explain that parallel between hemorrhage and heart failure is actually not frivolous.
That's actually a pretty important point.
And that's where...
Wait, say that again? The connection
between acute hemorrhage and heart failure is not an idle point in evolutionary biology terms. And it's not unlikely that the entire syndrome of heart failure, which is not a disease, a syndrome, is based on the same physiologic maladaptive mechanism, as we call it, which is initially developed as a response to naturally occurring low blood pressure. Naturally occurring low blood pressure only can happen in a young, strong organism under one circumstance, is bleeding. So, which in natural conditions probably a lot. You fight, you know, all this thing.
Right, so caveman, dinosaur bites arm.
Yeah, there are no
caveman.
Chronic disease, but there are plenty of hemorrhage in those days. And so what would you...
Knife cuts off
what
arm.
Would you expect the body to do in response to hemorrhage? One thing is to preserve volume, to preserve sodium, because there is no IV. You cannot give somebody an IV and hang a bag, you know. It was not available. So you want to conserve all the volume you can. So this is a very, very powerful mechanism which was built into every human being, and every mammal for that matter, as a response to hemorrhage. Now we don't have acute hemorrhage anymore, sort of as much of obvious reasons, but we do have a lot of people walking around with low cardiac output because their heart has been damaged.
But the basic
physiology is the same.
Right, just to expand a little bit. So, you know, if you're bleeding, what your body does is start to shut down blood flow to all the things it doesn't need to try to keep the brain, non-essential organs. Trying to keep the heart and the brain alive. So first the skin goes, then muscles, then, you know, kidney, liver, etc. So neurally, you vasoconstrict hormonally cause vasoconstriction of those things to maintain, keep the blood, you know, as much blood central as you can. And then what happens is if the bleeding stops, usually the amount of time that they had no blood flow or low blood flow to those organs, young people can recover. So, you know, so what was originally a very good adaptive mechanism became maladaptive because your body senses lower than normal cardiac output in heart failure as bleeding. So we now have a sort of teleological or evolutionarily adaptive mechanism that now in today's world became maladaptive because people lived long enough to develop the syndrome of heart failure.
So this nicely illustrates the physiology behind that led you to think about this. Take us back to those early days. You've got this insight.
Okay.
You've got this idea.
So we're sitting. Mark and I actually have never been in an office where we had separate offices. We always have the same, you know, desks in the same office, mostly because we yell at each other a lot.
Yeah.
So, and it's just too hard to get up. I'm too lazy to get up and walk to the next office.
Yell at him.
But we're sitting there, and all of a sudden, we're thinking, you know, why is it, how is the neuro student, don't understand. We go, remember back when we did that? We cut the artery, and there was a lot of urine coming out, and then the artery was intact. We cut the nerves. Okay, so it's not, there wasn't like any one thing that told you that this was absolutely going to be the right thing, right, or that it was absolutely going to work. But you keep piecing together all these things into this one general idea, take it to the lab, try and do it in the animals, block the kidneys, etc. And we tried to shop it to everybody.
Yeah, so you had the concept that there's something here, and you tried to take it. This is going to lead us to the story of the foundry, but tell us about your early experience in trying to create your own company in this space, and what led you eventually to the foundry?
We believed in it enough to quit our jobs. You know, we actually had jobs before, and after we started that, we didn't. That was a big transition.
Right. That was motivational to get money to, you know. So you, if my kids weren't addicted to food and shelter, it wouldn't have been as much of an issue.
We both quit our jobs in order to go and raise money for this venture. So that puts under a lot of pressure, especially.
Mark was smoking at the time, 10 bucks a pack. It was really bad.
So you're talking about the early 2000s. At this point,
this is 2003. Okay, so 2003, we started trying to shop this. And we made the first mistake we made was we actually believed venture capitalists. Not John, I'm really sorry to say that. But we believe venture capitalists, okay? And so we had a venture capitalist we shopped it to, and they said, absolutely, and they kept saying that, and they said, tomorrow we're giving you a term sheet. Okay, so we're getting a term sheet. We don't need to talk to anybody else. This is really good, right? They call us up and say, oh, sorry, we're funding CVRX. I say,
the truth to be told, what we were shopping really at that stage was a science project. If somebody funded it, it would have been a miracle.
Matter of fact, Hansen said we were shopping a science project.
Yeah. He said that, and it would be a natural response from me if somebody brought it today. That was 10 years ago. We were pretty inexperienced. We didn't quite understand what a well-defined sort of target is for venture capital investment. We were thinking in a different plane. Specifically, what we did know that we need to file a lot of intellectual property because the words renal and nerve were never encountered in the patent database at that time in
together.
The same reference.
Yeah.
You don't see that very often. There are hundreds of thousands of patent references. You always see some kind of prior art. To do a search of the world patent database and not find those two things together was quite an event. So we could recognize the opportunity on that. Even if we didn't see anything else, we realized that whatever happens with this fundamental physiologic pathway to a new cure, we need to file as many patents as possible, as many possible therapies and potential device embodiments
as we can afford. And that was a big problem for us because one of the big mistakes we made, and it was a mistake just because we didn't. So we took money we made from CHF Solutions and lived on it while we were doing this, right? We're supporting ourselves. And one of the problems was that we made a conscious decision not to file PCTs. And the reason is we just didn't have the money and decided, even though it wasn't a lot now,
we could not pursue international strategy on the kind of money we
didn't
had.
Know. We were too new to know that international strategy was a major issue. We'll make that mistake again. But, you know, we shopped it for everything because really it's sympathetic modulation, our mantra, right? So we shopped it for hypertension. We shopped it for heart failure. We shopped it for slowing the progression of chronic renal disease. We changed the presentation to every single VC we went to simply based on what we thought they would want.
But I thought your position at that point was around heart failure rather than...
Well, we had some minimal data. We told them hypertension. They didn't like hypertension. We told them chronic renal disease. Yes, we were just trying to get money.
Well, so it's sometimes a venture fund already has a hypertension company in their portfolio. Lots of them at the time did. That was one of the problems with hypertension. So we said, well, okay, you already have a hypertension company. We'll sell you a chronic renal failure company. Nobody has one.
So in the end, we got lucky. And we got lucky because we had known Hansen previously from some other stuff we worked with together, and he showed up with FNA, and he sat down, and we talked about it, and they thought about it for a long time, and then, you know, end of 2004, they actually took it over, which was great, because at the time, we didn't have the experience to take it from, you know, what we thought would be a medical device to a real medical device. And I think it's a great example because, you know, there are things we can do now that we couldn't do then, but no matter what, you really, everybody adds, the Ardian is not the, is not one person's success, okay? There were a lot of very good people who contributed. We contribute our part. Hansen, the foundry, contributed their part. You know, Andrew Cleland and team contributed their part. You know, everything went along to do it. Without any of those people, in the end, and a lot of luck, it wouldn't have succeeded. So, you know, we were really lucky that Hansen took it over.
So, Mark, you just said that one of the things that you think distinguished Caridia from other incubators, if you call what you guys do an incubation, that you work on one project at a time, and yet, as you say, you go through, you start with 25 ideas, you whittle it down. Was there ever a point before you got to the foundry where you said to yourself, you know what, we've got lots of other things we could be working on, why don't we just try those, why don't we just give this up, this looks like it's going to be too hard, or what was it about the tenacity of staying with this really novel concept, which had to be one of the obstacles to getting this thing funded, why did you just move on to Plan B or to
we couldn't let this go. It was obviously such a big opportunity. I think the sheer size of the opportunity was what kept us calm. We tried to fund other companies and smaller opportunities. Actually, in parallel, we did what became a renal guard project. It's a contrast nephropathy. Mm-hmm. And we did it specifically because we needed to generate cash flows to sustain the effort. So we actually contracted to a company called PLC Medical, which was a TMR company originally. Went public, had $1 billion valuation. Contracted back to a very small valuation because not for the fault of the execution team, which was pretty good actually. It was well managed professionally. It's just the physiologic concept behind a laser revascularization just didn't work. You couldn't make it work, no matter what. No execution team could save that. And to their credit, at some point they realized that, and their board came out and said, well, we need a new product because this concept is just not working, but we still have about $10 million cash in the bank left from the IPO. So they came to us and they asked us to find an opportunity for us, for them. And we can already considered ourselves experts in opportunity assessments. Thanks to Wilkerson Group, yes, it taught us a couple of buzzwords, so we knew how to use those buzzwords in order to get business. And we said, well, we'll find an opportunity.
You have to say them really loud. If you want people to believe you, say
it over and over again.
Yeah, and they were looking for something opposite because they were looking for a small market, maybe $20, $30 million in revenue. Which they could protect through the proprietary mechanism, which will be interventional cardiology market, but where they won't have to compete with companies like Boston Scientific and...
They didn't want something big enough that would be attractive to Medtronic Boston Scientific, but it was that significant enough revenue, so that, what was like 30, 50 million in revenue?
Yeah, something like that, and we put a lot of effort into that project, but that project actually sustained us, so we didn't have to go and find another job.
While we were shopping,
we could be working on the renal denervation in the background. It was very frustrating. But now we realize that, you know, it's a lot easier to sell a small project than a big project somehow.
There's actually another great example of physiology. Okay, so this contrast nephropathy project. So they came to us and said, you know, okay, we've identified, you know, this as a market opportunity. And, you know, we looked at it and we went through it and we agreed with them. You know, we gave them like a bunch of choices and they took contrast nephropathy. So we went and actually looked at the underlying physiology of contrast nephropathy. And in the end, there's no difference in the physiology of contrast nephropathy between too much glucose or too much mannitol or too much antibiotics or whatever. They all tend at certain concentrations to be toxic to the kidney. So we looked at all different ways of, and it's because they make the kidney use too much energy, really from sodium reabsorption. So that's sort of how this all ties together in the end. But what happened was is we developed a device that was able to, really simple concept, you make people generate urine. So you give them a bolus of fluid, you give them half of a milligram per kilogram of Lasix, they start peeing, you have a Foley, you measure the urine coming out, and you give them back exactly the same amount of fluid. So and people get this fast, feed forward response where they start making lots and lots and lots of urine. So you can get people making like 2 liters of urine an hour. And if you didn't give them back, they'd dry into a prune. But by giving it back and keeping them euvolemic, one, the kidney thinks there's no need to retain sodium and use, and so use energy. Two, you get the concentration of the toxin, in this case contrast, in the urine low enough so it doesn't bother the kidney. It has a very fast transit time through. And all of these drugs, and contrast is a drug, have just same pharmacokinetic profile. So they go up, and in 2 hours, they get down to the level where your kidney can just remove them in the background in time without hurting them.
So it's very hard. Imagine now that we're working around, like now, and people visit us, but at the time, to go into an office of a venture capitalist and start with a physiologic theory was not what you typically did in order to get funded.
You know, what you did when you didn't
yes,
want to
exactly,
get funded.
Yes, exactly, but you didn't want to get funded. You would bring, I remember positively a venture capitalist of some repute who told me he will never fund a company where pitch includes a single histology slide. And, you know, I will not disclose the name. Nevertheless, you all know the name. And there was a reason they were making a lot of money on bone screws and things like that at the time. That was a period in the industry, which you remember very well, when the very simple medical devices were able to generate fantastic returns.
So well, and you could argue today that those kinds of pressures are even greater on VCs. I want to get back to the Ardian story, though.
Yeah.
So you guys find the foundry, and you license the technology.
Mm-hmm.
How long did you stay with the Ardian project? What did you do for once it was within the confines of the foundry? And how quickly were you on to your next thing?
We tried to get out of their way as much as possible. And so we stayed about a year. And we tried to pass along the underlying physiology. But they really took it over, ran with it, got it from electroporation from drug infusion to electroporation to RF ablation. And then once they got there, it ends up, you know, with Andrew and the other guys taking over. We came back at the end to do a very interesting thing. Andrew hired us back in 2010, or right the year before the acquisition, 2009, 2010, in order to look at a bunch of alternate ways to do it. So, you know, we looked at everything from cryo to, you know, ultrasound like Kona to, you know, all these different things. We prototyped some stuff on the bench, filed a lot of IP, and really tried to sort of protect against the fast followers.
But, you know, Ardian brought up this fundamental question. If you're innovating in the area of physiology, which really is by itself not patentable and such, and there are multiple technologies applicable to that particular physiological anatomic target, can you protect that space and maintain the leadership position, which is a situation with Medtronic and acquisition of Ardian? So, and the only answer we know to it is build a bigger intellectual property portfolio. Mm-hmm. There's no other way. And keep innovating. Of course, that's a second answer to it. Don't stop innovating ever, you know, just maintain leadership. But also building that intellectual portfolio. And most of medical device companies tend to build intellectual property portfolio, which is basically defensive. They carve out their space between other spaces in that field or that market that they share with many others, and they defend fiercely their approach to the problem. What we try to do, and now we do it better because we have more money and more skills and we have better people working for us, is trying to also think of how other people would approach that problem and build intellectual property portfolio not only in the pathway of our most likely technology, but other technologies that are relevant in this space. Which is a big work.
And now we have to do it earlier because, you know, especially early on with renal denervation, nobody even paid attention to it. You know, nobody, you know, there was no big company worried about it. Now, because there's such a thing as interventional hypertension, there's such a thing as sympathetic modulation, unless you start protecting it right up front, and really you only have 18 months before everybody knows what you're doing if they don't know it before that, right, with all the, you know, when the patents start getting published, you really have a really short time to cram things in, especially in this white space stuff. So,
go ahead.
So, you know, that's one big difference from 10 or 15 years ago. The other difference from 10 or 15 years ago is that just because over time we acquired more experience and skills, you know, we're able to sort of see, take things through the first, say, 20, 30 patients or so, right? So from back in a napkin through 20, 30 patients. There's a big advantage to that, and there's a big disadvantage to that, in the sense that it allows you to see what, you know, all these different things you can do, but you only get really one shot at what you do.
But, you know, it seems to me that one of the challenges, that both the challenge and the opportunity for renal denervation was that no one was working on it. Marcus, you said there was, you know, if you look at the patent law, no one had put renal and nerve together in any individual patent. IP protection is one side of it, but if no one ever actually wants to develop the idea, the IP protection isn't worth very much. Mark, you said something once that was very interesting. You said it took you guys 10 years to learn something that someone at Boston Scientific knows intuitively, which is that at some point doctors have to want to adopt and use this device. When you're working on something at renal denervation, or when you're going back deeply into the physiology and explaining it, it seems to me that's partly where your model hits a kind of wall, which is science sounds great, the physiology is really sound, but whether you're talking about a physician or whether you're talking about the biz dev guy at a large strategic or a VC who's got to fund this, it just doesn't resonate with them yet.
You know, yes and no. I mean, luckily, you know, as you've said before, you get a little success, you get a little credibility, people listen, even though, you know, what you say is like, you know, the stupidest thing. And, you know, some of the times we're just lucky in that we're able to pick large unmet clinical needs. And people, I think staying within those large unmet clinical needs that the biz dev guys actually understand already or their physicians understand already is good. But as soon as we get outside that, if you want to take something that's like totally novel and doesn't fit into an existing structure or people don't believe it, that's where you have to generate those things. And that's where doing these early patients and getting data made the difference between something like Arden and something like what we're doing now.
It's not only that. It's also, I think one of the great things about RDN was that so many physicians stood up and said, I want to do this procedure. I can do this procedure. You know,
they got what renal denervation.
Yeah, exactly. Got. Renal denervation, because they recognize the tools, they recognize the setting, they recognize the imaging modality that they already learned. It was a huge investment. It's almost like leveraging that huge investment that society made in training those doctors, in creating the subspecialty, in equipping those cath labs, and developing the imaging that you use. You know, so you just, I always say it's like building a railroad is a very big project. Putting a train on the tracks with a faster locomotive, that's where you want to make a lot of money.
But if you want to say what we know now that we didn't know mm-hmm. then that the foundry did know, okay, mm-hmm. and made the difference, a major difference, is that, so, you know, now as we go through our matrix and try and evaluate stuff, you know, does it use existing skill sets, or, you know, who's the right acquirer, you know, is it interventional cardiologist? Stents are going down so that they're looking for, or interventional cardiologists are looking for other things to do. We actually shopped this to a major medical device manufacturer in 2003. We made it all the way to corporate. We made it all the way through their medical director blessing it and saying whatever. But because it was a implantable drug pump, at the time, they couldn't find somebody within their existing corporate structure who would put it on their P&L.
So I want to get to Cibium, I want to get to the next project. I just tipped mm-hmm. my hand at what it is. But let's just pursue this for one more second, because as working at the basic physiology, you come up with some really disruptive ideas, some really disruptive opportunities. But it seems to me that when you get to the point where you're talking to corporate acquirers, you're also veering away from core strategic areas to potentially white spaces. Howard, you called them once to me gray areas rather than white gray spaces rather than white spaces. So how do you deal with that as an issue? Because at some point you do, particularly your model is you want to flip this to somebody quickly.
You want beat your head against the wall mercilessly until somebody breaks, and you need somebody to break, and then everybody else gets interested.
So our transition between CHF solutions, for example, is that in RDN we learned a lot, and we learned enormous amount from Foundry, and CHF solutions fundamentally had that problem. It was a model that a VC at the time told me, now all we need to find out if dogs want to eat dog food or not. You know, that was how medical device companies would establish valuation. They would enter the marketplace and they will look at the ramp and they will get acquired on multiples. Now, of majority of the money that they were equipped with would go into that marketing effort, which is very expensive. And it may or may not succeed for reasons totally unrelated to the technology of physiologic foundations. And we wanted to spend more money on actual fundamentals of research, and then we started looking at the drug model and say, well, look at the drug people, you know, they have venture capitalists, they make investments, they have very high return on investments. They don't see, you know, if dogs eat dog food, they don't try to market drugs, they don't see the drug reps walking around. So obviously they all get acquired earlier. Their customer is actually the chief technologist or the chief medical officer of the large pharmaceutical. And they bring their clinical data sets and their intellectual property to that group of peers, and they judge them and they buy them for what they want.
Which is
an opening for us. Maybe we can do it.
And that's what we've been doing for the past 5 years. Basically, we've been going to the medical officers. We don't go to the BD people. Because, you know, first of all, everybody, it's really funny. So you get somebody who's new in the area and they say, wow, I talked to company X and they were really excited. I said, they're paid to be really excited to tell you that. You know, BD people are paid to be excited about where and may have nothing to do with this, but you know, the corporate has already decided what money they're gonna spend on which things. They have the thing planned. They have a white space committee who nobody listens to, right? And so when you come to them, you have to get in somehow. So for us, we've taken a pharma approach. And the pharma approach is not to, you know, well, there are two ways. One is to say, if you did have something and some sales guy says, wow, did you see that? That's eating my lunch. We have to go get that. But that's, again, not what we do. What we do is we take the approach of going to, you know, just because we know them now, going to the CMOs or going to the scientists or going to whatever within the institution and educating them. Because most of the stuff, including what we're doing right now, people never heard of before.
So let's focus on what you're doing now. And Caridi is now on, or recently launched, I think this last June, a company called Cibium.
Correct.
Tell us about Cibium. And you mentioned to me when we were doing the article for InVivo that you guys were not execution guys. You leave those issues to whether it's the foundry as an intermediary or to the acquiring company that's going to actually make this work.
Right.
Does Cibium represent an evolution, a change in any sense?
Yes.
Or are you still basically idea generators?
We're idea generators. And we have a Stanford biodesign alum in the audience, Ken Martin, who's our CEO.
Yay, Ken, wherever he is.
Yep. Here he is. And, you know, and a lot of the team is here. The issue is what we decided is we wanted to bring on a CEO with, you know, who has the ability to execute and run through rough times with new things. So Ken came from Sadra, of course, and that was a great run and a great, you know, win. And what we do is we still generate the idea and work to get it through to the, you know, tested in humans, you know, ready to go forward. But then taking it from there through to an actual product, you know, a commercial device, is not our skill set. Yeah,
but choosing the indication and technology and things like this, we are becoming a more physiology marketing group. We're still not really a technology development group. In that sense, I don't think we will ever cross that line and become, say, well, we're going to develop this product and we're not going to achieve the regulatory approvals that are associated, do execute a multi-center clinical trial, or do things like that.
Have we done 5 PKs in the past? Yeah. Have we done PMAs in the past? Yeah. But we're just not.
That's not what we do.
So one of the differences between Cibium and your early idea, early concept for Ardian was that you did not have venture capital when you were taking renal denervation out. You started Cibium. You started Nuco One with a base of two venture capitalists. Tell us, and does that make it easier? Does it make it
billion % easier? Just billion % easier. So you know, every time we made money previously, starting with CHF Solutions, we would roll that money over whatever we made into the next one in order to sort of self-fund ourselves. And you know, we got to the point in 2010 where we were lucky. We wanted to do this, and we found two groups, SV Life Sciences and Third Rock, who were willing to do this. And it's a very unusual structure. Basically, it's almost like, so we said, okay, we don't know what we're going to build, and we don't know what's going to come out of the other end, but we're going to trust each other that we're going to come up with something that's really good and you'll like. You'll like what we have and will fund us, and that we'll all agree on a field that we can come up to, you know, make an intellectual property deal at the end. And that was a very novel structure, and we tried it on a bunch of people, and some people just didn't like it. Some people were uncomfortable with it, and we were lucky enough to find these two groups who were willing to go with it. It has been a boon for us in the sense that we don't have to take our previous money and put it into the next one.
Have you stepped back the way you did with Ardian? As once turning over, now that you've got a CEO.
Ken's now a month into being on board, and we're very lucky to have him. It's a great thing. We're going through this transition. So over the next, you know, 6, 9, you know, hopefully by the end of 2013, he'll get rid of us, and we'll move on to more full-time with our next incubator.
We clearly are becoming more and more of a bridge, sort of translation bridge, because we dig deeper into academic research and basic research. We actually go into those animal labs, and we initiate those university projects, really, with quite a few of them recently. And we now follow deeper into the early stages of product development, but more as a consultants rather than leaders.
What we're trying to make sure is that, okay, Mark hates this analogy. That's why I use it. What I said, our job is to head the battleship in the right direction. You know, because once the battleship's going and underway, you can sort of change it 15 degrees. It's really hard to make a 360. Also, the thing that people don't understand is early on, it's just Mark and me, and then, you know, we added Zor, and then we added, you know, went on. And the thing is that the most important thing is to make your mistakes when things are really cheap at a low burn rate. You know, you can try a lot of things when you have a low burn rate.
It's amazing what
Once
you can
you
get away with.
Once you start to get a lot of people, you can't change direction a lot anymore. So, you know, our job was to arm Ken and the team with what we think is a valuable idea, proof that it works, you know, a path towards clinical, early data. And then, you know, we then are institutional history, so to speak. You know, because I remember one time with CHF Solutions, we went back to visit them a few years later, and we said, oh, why are you guys doing that? They said, well, you said this had to be done. We go, we pulled that out of our butt. Are you kidding me? You know, that was just the best idea we had at the time. You're actually supposed to revisit your assumptions, you know? Yes. So that's really what it is, you know, when we get to the point where they said, well, you know, we're doing, you know, why'd you do this? We're available to say, well, this was it. It may, you know, in retrospect, maybe we could do it another, there might be a better way. Or, you know, we did it specifically for this reason because there's this clinical and physiological specific thing that needed to be done.
We're right up against time. Let me ask one more question, and then I'd like to take some questions from the floor if there are any. But
just remember, never convicted. That is the most important thing to remember out of this whole talk.
Let me play devil's advocate here. I mean, I hope one of the things that we've been able to do over the last 45 minutes is to kind of showcase or illustrate how your approach is really different. But I think most people who are attracted, and I would assume that SVLS and Third Rock, the extent they were attracted to working with you guys, or do so not because you're so conceptually or philosophically different or novel, but because of your track record with Ardian and with Medtronic's huge purchase price. But in terms of medical device success, I would argue that Ardian isn't so much a case study, it's a real outlier. Wouldn't it be really awfully difficult to do Ardian again? What kind of expectations realistically can you have for the new companies that are coming out?
I think it'd be done again, but I think it requires a change in paradigm. You cannot take making a better or an evolutionary change in a device or an evolutionary change in something and expect it to come out with ridiculous returns. You have to do sort of more white space stuff. And I think that taking this sort of semi-pharma, semi-device approach to this gives us the opportunity to put therapies where, or, you know, you have to make a franchise. You know, so interventional hypertension is a franchise. Or you have to make a novel way to access that franchise in a different way that will still bring a different part of the population. I don't know, Mark.
No, I think we actually live in a good times, and in a good times for people in this room. And I can explain why. In spite of the FDA and in spite of funding, this is a very good time to be in the medical device field, primarily because of the tremendous failure of drug therapies and the pipelines of big drug companies. And that creates opportunity not to create new, better catheter with a hook on the end, but to start opening up new therapies because the diseases are still there. There are millions of people with heart failure, with renal failure, with hypertension. Drugs did not make them healthy. They promised in 20, 30 years ago. And what they delivered really is people on 5-6 medication with side effects of this medication are worse than drugs they're taking. And they made a full loop, and now their pipelines are empty.
But another thing to go along exactly what you're saying, a device therapy can never, in my opinion, can never be successful where there's a viable drug therapy. It just, you can't compete against a pill with a device. However, there are take resistant hypertension, okay? Resistant hypertension, you can argue the numbers, but let's say it's 10% of all hypertensives, okay? That's a $26 billion market. That's, you know, of the 70 or 80 million people, that's 7 to 10 million people at X dollars a pop. It's just a huge market. So you don't have to, you know, have, you know, millions and billions of people you're giving a pill to at a time.
If you do the same thing in diabetes, don't you think you will be acquired for a lot of money again?
Yeah, well, certainly.
Let's put it this way. You know?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, how can you not?
Here's hoping for say two. Unfortunately, we're really up against time. I do want to leave time for questions. Let's thank Mark and Howard for sharing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
I can tell you from personal experience, you couldn't find a more fascinating thing than to spend a couple of hours with these guys talking about technology development and where the medical device ideas come from. If you got a question, come to the microphone here. I saved actually a couple just in case people are moving slowly. So you guys are famous for Ardian and renal denervation. And last time I spoke to him, Martin Rothman told me that there were 62 from Medtronic, 62 companies in renal denervation. You guys talk about the importance of starting very early, doing a lot of basic physiology. In the device world, it's almost axiomatic that the first guy through doesn't win. It's the guys who learn and iterate. How do you make certain that you actually are achieving success and aren't just setting up the next companies who will learn from your basic science, particularly since you guys are doing a lot of the fundamental research that most device companies don't do?
So the thing is that of those, you know, a lot of those fast followers were retargeted failed startups. You know, they all had an RF catheter, they all have an ultrasound catheter, whatever. They're trying to take their piece of the thing. And certainly, you know, some of them get bought for a couple hundred million, $100 million, plus earnouts, whatever it is. The question is, 100 million and 800 million or a billion are two different things. So if you want to actually, fast followers are unlikely to make a new franchise. They're unlikely to open up an opportunity that, you know, can be a half billion north. So the question then becomes, you know, do we want to work in those areas and be fast forward? We actually thought about it a lot. We thought about, should we try and come up, we were actually in the meeting we had before with the biodesign fellows. One of the questions we had was, or we were discussing is, should you, instead of working on a white space thing, should you develop a new therapy that gets rid of a device? So take BIV pacing, for example, okay? If you could come up with a one-time therapy, or you could come up with some other thing that got rid of BIV pacing, that certainly would be a huge opportunity, mm-hmm. mostly because it's got reimbursement. Mm-hmm. So the question is, you focus on things that have reimbursement and go after them, and can you, you know, so even though you're sort of a fast follower, what you're doing is you'd have to develop a new therapy with it, you know, making another shiny can with a battery and a lead won't get you a lot of money. But if you develop something totally novel to replace it with existing reimbursement and a huge market, it might.
But to answer your question, it's a very tough question, and only time will answer that question. You understand that. Yeah. You're asking the question that has no theoretical answer. We will meet again in 5 years, and the answer will be staring us in the face. So we believe, and it's our matter, that yes, through early stage development of intellectual property portfolio, just like people do in the drug world, again, the pharma, you don't have this fear of generics in pharma just because the formula is now known. So with technologies, it's the same. Technologies are mostly known today. It's the new markets that they open, new applications of this technology. So can we protect this? Can Medtronic protect it? Can they be dynamic enough to move ahead of the crowd and iterate the technology fast? I think the answer from consumer products always information technology was you have to cannibalize your own products first or somebody else will do it. So if Apple released the first iPhone and never progressed to the next one, probably there wouldn't be Apple now.
Well, it's funny, I asked Omar Ishrak, he didn't greenlight Ardian, and obviously Bill Hawkins did, but I asked him whether he, with any trepidations or any concerns on his part that Medtronic placed a big bet on too early a technology and might have done better to wait for a second generation. And he felt that just the opposite, that in fact, this is one area where being first out of the gates would actually give Medtronic a huge advantage over the ones that were coming after. So at least Medtronic is convinced. Are there any questions from the audience? Not as secure as one, we'll take one and then.
Hello, thank you for that wonderful discussion. Murtaza, nice to meet you. My question is regarding the very beginning of your process when you're looking at ideas, the menu. How are you going about that? Do you look at the major medical conditions or the high mortality ones and then sample them out? Or, you start with a clinical vignette. I've seen too many folks die from PE on the table in the ER while you're pushing TPA at 35 years old. And are those ideas, innately doomed to failure because you're starting off with this passionate sort of, emotionally charged sort of thing? How do you deal with that?
Those projects are innately doomed because they're not a business. That's the problem. They're really great for mankind and whatever, and I would love to do those. I cannot get a venture capitalist to give me money to do something that doesn't have a B after the number. It's the practical world. So if you're gonna go after, for us, like if you're gonna go after white space ideas and stuff like that, it has to be. Now, it doesn't mean there's not a niche or a role for going after PE, in the ER. That's certainly something that's clinically very important. And if you could develop a therapy or a device on the right amount of money so that it matched the revenue that you could get from it, there's probably somebody you could get that would fund it. But in the areas that we generally work in, we take a little bit of a different approach where we say, okay, take huge, huge, huge markets that happen to fit our background knowledge, etc.
Oh, honestly, we're pretty expensive in this. Early stages become pretty expensive for to do what you just described. And since our mantra is to dig deep into the project rather than do five projects simultaneously, it has to be a big market opportunity. Right. There's just no alternative.
And the thing is, the thing about the really, really big opportunities is that, you can have whatever niche you get is always going to be huge enough that it's, you know, very fundable and very large. But, you know, you can fund smaller projects. It just, you have to do it on the amount of money and time so that the return on that is appropriate for the cash flow that they're going to get from it.
So you're looking at the major medical conditions, and then you're going digging deeper into the physiology to sort of come up with solutions.
Well, what we try and do is find the problem. So, you know, let's say, I'm just picking this up, but, you know, insulin resistance and diabetes, okay? The question is, you know, you can give a pill, right? Or for us, we'd like to see if you can find a fundamental underlying physiological pathway that we can interrupt or that we can excite that would then take care of that insulin resistence. You know, that's just sort of a generic example.
Let's give you a different example where one of the problems we are very interested in, for example, is chronic renal failure in dialysis, progression to dialysis, because it's a major disaster on the social level. Obviously, we all know how much money.
So what's the best thing you can do to fix dialysis?
Yeah, so we spend some time looking at dialysis and seeing, can we really improve dialysis? So lots of companies trying, and conclusion we came up, which our own conversation is impossible. You cannot do in 4 hours what nature does in 3 days. And, you know, their diffusion is one process. It goes against the laws of physics to make dialysis better following existing
models. I learned that from Star Trek.
Yeah, so we don't fight laws of physics, but we're very creative, but we don't go that far.
Yes,
if it's against, right. No change in gravitational constant of the universe or something like that included. So what we decided is that if we want to approach it, our approach would be to either dramatically delay or prevent altogether the progression to dialysis, a need for dialysis, by preserving residual renal function, which is usually residual renal function is plenty of renal function for somebody to last 15 years without dialysis. The question of how to do it now, we believe it's a device opportunity. We don't really have a device for it yet, but as I said, we never leave a problem like this. Once we found opportunity like this, I guarantee you we'll go back to it every 6 months.
It goes back on the shelf. It goes back on the shelf and gets recycled.
Yes. And we'll have that discussion in a couple weeks. Unfortunately, we really do have to end now because we do have a reception outside. We want to thank these guys very much, I think, for
a great session.
Thank you for the opportunity. And go outside unless, Paul, you want to say anything more.
Sure. Okay. But I will get on.